The air changed before I even stepped inside. It was cold, sterile, like breathing through old Medicaid gauze. Not the usual cocktail of rust, piss, and recycled breath I'd grown up with. This was something else, something clean in a place that should never be. I adjusted my rebreather as the rest of my sump rats filed into the collapsed tunnel behind me. The beam from my lumpen staff caught motes of dust dancing in the darkness, undisturbed for Emperor knows how long until we blundered in. The tunnel had given way decades ago, forgotten by the hive dwellers above, but not by those of us who made our living from the forgotten places. Necromunda forgives nothing, but she rewards the desperate, and the sump rats were nothing if not desperate. The cargo hauler lay half buried in rubble, its massive hull breaching through the collapsed ferrocrete like some ancient leviathan surfacing from the depths. Imperial markings, faded but still visible, adorned its side, an administratum seal. Registration plates, manufacturing stamps from a forge world I didn't recognize. The hauler was old, I'd never seen anything like it intact before, just scraps and pieces traded in the underhive markets. Fenks whistled low behind me, the sound muffled by his rebreather. The others spread out, their excitement palpable even through their hazard gear. Eight of us in total, the full strength of the sump rats. Not the biggest gang in the underhive, but we'd survived this long by being smarter, not stronger. I ran my gloved hand over the hull, wiping away decades of grime to reveal the designation, MX-45. The knowledge surfaced from somewhere deep in my memory, passed down from my ratskin ancestors who'd navigated these tunnels since before the uprising. An administratum class MX-45 cargo transport. Stories whispered around sump fires spoke of a massive Medicaid shipment bound for mid-hive during the chaos of 939. The hauler vanished in transit, presumed destroyed or looted, yet here it stood, apparently untouched. Jax and Lorna unpacked the salvaged Melta cutters, their movements practiced and efficient. The twins had been with me the longest, having survived three territory wars and countless skirmishes with rival gangs. If anyone could breach this ancient vessel, it was them. The rest of us formed a perimeter. Dex with his long laws took up position on a chunk of fallen ceiling, while Cora and Meeks checked the tunnel for signs of recent activity. The final member of our crew, Holt, monitored the auspex for life signs or energy signatures. The needle remained steady, nothing alive in there, nothing powered up, just as it had been for decades. The Melta cutters flared to life, bathing the tunnel in harsh orange light. The twins worked in silence, methodically cutting through the primary seal of the cargo hauler. The metal groaned and resisted, but eventually surrendered with a hiss of escaping air, stale but breathable according to Holt's readings. I was the first to enter, as always. The sump rats followed my lead or didn't follow at all. That was how we survived in the underhive. Inside, my lumpen staff revealed not the open cargo bay I'd expected, but a labyrinth. Containers had been arranged in corridors and chambers, welded together to form a complex of interconnected spaces. This was no standard cargo configuration. Someone had transformed the hauler's interior into something else entirely. The walls were lined with equipment I recognized from salvage runs near the Medicaid sectors. Surgical tables bolted to the floor, monitoring devices suspended from overhead tracks, preservation tanks large enough to hold a full-grown man. But these bore modifications I'd never seen before, augmetic interfaces, mechanical arms tipped with instruments that looked more suited to dissection than healing, and everywhere the faded insignia of the Adeptus Mechanicus Biologos division. I'd seen it only once before, on a data slate traded for a month's worth of filtered water. The biological research sect of the Mechanicus wasn't common on Necromunda, or if they were, they operated far above the underhive, in realms we scavengers never saw. Dust covered everything in a thick, undisturbed layer, decades worth. The preservation tanks contained cloudy fluids, obscuring whatever specimens they might have once held. Most were empty now, their contents either removed or decayed beyond recognition. The surgical tables told a more disturbing story. Each was fitted with adamantium restraints, not the standard restraints used in Medicaid facilities, but heavy-duty bindings designed to hold something far stronger than a compliant patient. Several showed signs of stress, as if whatever had been secured there had fought violently to escape. Holt's auspex still showed nothing living, but my instincts, honed through years of surviving the underhive, screamed caution. We moved deeper into the labyrinth, passing workstations cluttered with augmetic components. Mechanical limbs, ocular implants, devices I couldn't identify but which seemed designed to interface with human anatomy in ways that defied conventional augmetics. Cora found a data slate, its power cells long dead. Meeks discovered a cache of tools that would fetch a handsome price in the trading posts of the Underhive. Valuable salvage, but nothing compared to what a fully stocked Medicaid transport should contain. No drugs, no medical supplies. Just the equipment for whatever procedures had been conducted here. The hauler grew colder as we penetrated deeper. The walls of the containers sweated condensation, creating puddles on the metal floor. Our breath fogged in front of our faces. Some environmental system, powered by who knows what, still functioned after all these years. In the third chamber, I noticed something odd. A single set of drag marks cut through the dust on the floor. Recent. The marks led toward a sealed inner door, heavy and reinforced, unlike the others we'd passed through. I signaled for silence, though no one had spoken since entering the hauler. The sump rats knew the value of quiet. Noise attracted predators in the Underhive, human and otherwise. The drag marks bothered me. The dust layer was thick, undisturbed for decades except for this single trail. Something had moved through here recently, or someone. Dex took position with his long laws covering the door while the twins prepared the melta cutters again. Holt's auspex remained frustratingly steady. Nothing alive, nothing powered, and yet those drag marks. The inner door yielded more easily than the outer seal, suggesting it had been opened more recently. As it swung open, cold air rushed out, carrying that same antiseptic smell, now tinged with something else. Something organic, the decay of flesh preserved too long. Beyond lay not another container chamber, but a vast cargo hold. The hauler's main compartment. Rows upon rows of preservation tanks lined the walls, larger than the ones we'd seen before. Surgical stations formed islands in the center of the space. And suspended from the ceiling, a complex system of tracks and mechanical arms that reminded me of the automated factories of the Mid-Hive. This was no Medicaid transport. This was a laboratory, a place of experimentation. Most of the tanks stood empty, their glass fronts shattered or doors hanging open. But some still contained cloudy fluid, and within those, shapes, human shapes or what had once been human. Forms altered, modified, enhanced with crude augmetics and biological grafts that had no place on a living being. Failed experiments, I realized, discarded test subjects. The drag marks continued across the floor of the hold, leading to a section where several tanks had been clustered together. Here, the dust had been disturbed more extensively. Something had moved around this area repeatedly, recently. One tank lay on its side, its fluid contents long since spilled and dried, its door hung open, empty. Holt's auspex suddenly chirped, the needle jumping briefly before settling back to baseline. He tapped the device, checking for malfunction. The needle jumped again, stronger this time, pointing toward the far end of the hold where shadows gathered beyond the reach of our looming globes. Something moved in those shadows, something large. I raised my hand, signaling the rats to hold position. The movement came again, a shifting of mass, the scrape of something heavy across metal flooring. A sound followed, wet and organic, the sound of breathing through damaged lungs. The auspex needle swung wildly now, its machine spirit suddenly awakened to the presence it had failed to detect earlier. Or perhaps whatever lurked in the darkness had only just roused from dormancy, triggered by our intrusion. Dex raised his long laws, sighting down its length toward the disturbance. Cora and Meeks drew their auto pistols. The twins readied their melta cutters, the pilot flames casting long shadows across the hold. I unholstered my own weapon, an ancient bolt pistol, my most prized possession, salvaged from the corpse of an enforcer during my early days in the Underhive. One magazine, six rounds. I'd never needed more than two for any single threat before. The shadows shifted again. Something emerged partially into the light, a limb, but not entirely human. Elongated, jointed in too many places, tipped with what looked like surgical instruments fused directly into the flesh. It probed the air, sensing, before withdrawing back into darkness. The drag marks on the floor suddenly made terrible sense. Not something being dragged, but something dragging itself. Something that had survived in this cold, sealed environment for decades. Something that had once been secured to one of those surgical tables before breaking free. Something that had once been human before the BioLogos division began their work. I signaled retreat. The salvage wasn't worth this. Nothing was, but as we began backing toward the entrance, the auspex shrieked. Multiple readings now where seconds before there had been only one. The thing in the shadows wasn't alone. and the door we'd entered through, our only exit from the main hold, slowly, silently swung closed. I didn't sleep that night, none of us did. After sealing the inner hold door with a makeshift barricade of empty containers and loose equipment, we retreated to establish a base camp near the hauler's entrance. The sump rats worked with practiced efficiency, transforming the first chamber into a defensible position. We'd survived long enough in the underhive to know that retreat wasn't an option, not with what we'd found. Whatever waited in the darkness beyond that door was valuable. Dangerous, yes, but valuable nonetheless. Lorna and Jack set up a perimeter of scavenged lumens, creating a circle of harsh white light that pushed back the shadows. The twins moved in perfect synchronicity, wordlessly passing tools and power cells between them as they worked. Dex positioned himself on an elevated platform of crates, his long laws sweeping the surrounding corridors. His face betrayed nothing, but I noted how his finger never strayed far from the trigger. Meeks established our Vox beacons, modified enforcer tech that would allow us to maintain communications throughout the labyrinthine hauler. The signal wouldn't penetrate the thick hull to reach the outside world, but at least we wouldn't lose each other in this metal maze. Cora, meanwhile, inventoried our supplies. Food and water for 3 days, ammunition, medical supplies, enough to complete our salvage operation, but not enough to withstand a prolonged siege. I watched Lo hunker down before a partially functioning cogitator we'd discovered in one of the side chambers. Our tech specialist's augmetic eye whirred as he connected a series of bypass cables to the ancient machine. His fingers, thin and nimble despite their mechanical nature, danced across the keys. Green text flickered across the screen, illuminating his scarred face in its sickly glow. Hours passed. Lo remained fixed to the cogitator, occasionally grunting in frustration or satisfaction as he navigated the machine's degraded memory cores. The rest of us maintained watch, checked equipment, or attempted to rest. I found myself repeatedly drawn to the barricaded door, straining to hear any sound from beyond. Nothing came, no scratching, no breathing, nothing to confirm what we'd seen in those shadows. Kilo took first watch. Our enforcer was the largest of us, a mountain of scar tissue and crude augmetics who had once served as a pit fighter in the mid-hive before a failed rebellion against his masters had sent him fleeing downward. His lasgun, a heavy pattern model designed for Astra Militarum veterans, seemed like a toy in his massive hands. I left him stationed near the entrance with instructions to wake me at the slightest disturbance. I must have dozed despite my intentions because I jolted awake to Lo's mechanical voice. He'd found something. The cogitator had yielded fragments of data, corrupted but partially recoverable. Project Metamorph, the files called it. An unauthorized gene splicing experiment conducted under the authority of a Magos biologist named Vex Macharia. The details were fragmented, but I could piece together enough. The Magos had been investigating the adaptive capabilities of Necromunda's indigenous fauna, particularly the carrion hunters. Those notorious predators were legendary even in the underhive, resilient beasts that thrived in the most toxic regions of our poisoned world. Their ability to survive in environments that would kill most creatures had drawn the Biologos division's interest, but the experiment hadn't stopped at observation. Vex Macharia had begun splicing carrion hunter genetic material with human subjects. The cogitator records were clinical, detached, typical of the Mechanicus. Test subjects had been acquired from the underhive, criminals, outcasts, people who wouldn't be missed, people like us. I felt my stomach tighten as I read over Lo's shoulder. The early experiments had failed spectacularly. Human physiology rejected the carrion hunter DNA, resulting in massive cellular degradation. Later attempts showed more promise but produced subjects with severe mutations, additional limbs, chitinous growths, enhanced sensory organs that drove the subjects to madness. A notification from Meek's Vox beacon interrupted my reading. Kilo hadn't checked in at the scheduled interval. I dispatched Dex to investigate, suddenly aware of how quiet our camp had become. Minutes later, his Vox crackled with a report that sent ice through my veins. Kilo was gone. His lasgun lay abandoned near his post, its power cell still warm. A trail of viscous fluid led from his position toward a container we'd previously marked as sealed. The container now stood open, revealing a network of maintenance ducts and crawl spaces between the cargo sections, a secondary transit system we hadn't detected in our initial sweep. I ordered everyone to pair up and maintain constant Vox contact. No one was to investigate alone. Dex returned to camp, bringing Kulo's lasgun and a sample of the fluid in a specimen vial. Lo analyzed it with his augmetic eye, confirming what I'd already suspected: it wasn't entirely human. The fluid contained compounds consistent with carrion hunter biology, but modified, enhanced. While the others secured the camp and searched nearby sections for any sign of Kulo, I returned to the cogitator with Lo. The tech specialist had recovered additional data fragments, including a series of research logs. Vex Macharia's notes revealed an obsession that had evolved beyond scientific inquiry into something resembling religious fervor. The Magos believed that by combining human adaptability with carrion hunter resilience, he could create the perfect survivor, a new breed of human capable of thriving in Necromunda's most hostile environments. The later entries grew increasingly erratic. Vex Macharia reported success with Subject Prime, a test subject who had achieved what he termed perfect biomimetic adaptation. Unlike previous subjects, Prime showed no outward mutations, but had developed the ability to alter its internal biology in response to environmental threats. More disturbingly, Prime had begun demonstrating increased intelligence and problem-solving abilities. The final entry was dated just before the uprising of 939. It contained only a single line: Subject Prime has escaped containment, initiating Biologos Protocol, Emperor forgive us. Lo managed to recover a partial definition of the Biologos Protocol from a subfolder of emergency procedures. In the event of catastrophic containment failure, the hauler was to be sealed and scuttled in the deepest, most inaccessible region of the Underhive, with all research personnel remaining on board to prevent contamination. The protocol explicitly forbade any attempt at rescue or recovery for a minimum of 100 years. We'd found the hauler just 60 years after its disappearance. My blood ran cold as I realized the implications. The hauler hadn't crashed during the uprising. It had been deliberately hidden. And if the protocol had been followed to the letter, the research team had remained on board, sealing themselves in with whatever had escaped from those tanks. A vox call from Jax and Lorna pulled me from these grim thoughts. The twins had discovered something while securing the perimeter, a sealed chamber adjacent to our base camp, hidden behind a false panel. I joined them immediately, bringing Lo and his data slate scanner. The chamber proved to be a makeshift laboratory, smaller than the main hold, but equipped with more specialized equipment. Preservation tanks lined the walls, each containing a suspended form. Failed test subjects preserved for further study. Human shapes with grotesquely altered anatomies, limbs elongated and jointed in impossible ways, torsos split to reveal secondary respiratory systems, skulls expanded to accommodate enlarged brain tissue. Some specimens showed chitinous growths erupting from their skin, forming natural armor plates. Others displayed multiple limb grafts, additional arms or legs fused to their bodies with varying degrees of success. In the center of the laboratory stood a single empty tank, larger than the others. A plaque on its base identified it as Subject Prime Incubation Chamber. The fluid had long since drained away, but the tank's interior was scarred with deep gouges. Something had clawed its way out. A bank of data slates rested on a nearby workstation. Most were dead, their power cells depleted decades ago, but Lo managed to extract information from three. The first contained anatomical diagrams of carrion hunters, annotated with notes on their adaptive biology. The second held personnel files for the research team, 12 members in total, led by Magos Vex Macharia himself. The third contained monitoring data for Subject Prime. The readings were unlike anything I'd seen before. Prime's vital signs fluctuated wildly, sometimes registering as multiple distinct patterns within the same organism. Its cellular structure appeared to be in constant flux, rearranging itself in response to stimuli. Most concerning were the brain activity readings, complex patterns that evolved over time, growing more sophisticated with each testing cycle. A notation at the bottom of the slate caught my eye: Subject Prime demonstrates unprecedented capacity for biomimetic adaptation, can now perfectly replicate any organic tissue it consumes. Recommendation: terminate project immediately. The entry was signed not by Vex Macharia, but by his second in command, a Magos biologist named Thren. A subsequent entry in different script had been added: recommendation denied, proceed to phase 3 testing. I was examining the failed specimens more closely when Meek's urgent vox call came through. During his patrol with Korra, they'd discovered something near the maintenance duct where Kulo had disappeared. A piece of fabric, part of Kulo's distinctive red bandana, snagged on a jagged edge of metal, and nearby, a handprint pressed into the dust on the floor. A handprint that started as human at the wrist, but elongated into something else entirely at the fingertips. The Vox suddenly erupted with static, then Cora's voice cut through, tense and breathless. They were being followed. Something was moving through the ducts alongside them, keeping pace, occasionally scratching at the metal walls. I ordered immediate retreat to base camp, but Cora's response was lost in another burst of static. I gathered the others and moved toward Cora and Meek's last reported position. As we navigated the narrow corridors between container sections, I became aware of sounds echoing through the metal labyrinth, scraping noises from above and below, as if something was traveling through the maintenance ducts that honeycombed the hauler. The sounds seemed to come from multiple directions simultaneously, converging on our position. We found Meeks unconscious near a junction, a gash across his forehead leaking blood onto the dusty floor. No sign of Cora. Another trail of viscous fluid led from Meek's position into a nearby duct, the grating torn away by something of considerable strength. As Lorna tended to Meek's wound, I noticed something clutched in his hand, a small mechanical device I didn't recognize. Lo identified it as an implant tag, the kind used by the Biologos division to track research specimens. The identification number was still visible, Prime 1. Meeks regained consciousness as we carried him back to base camp. His eyes were wide with terror as he described what had happened. He and Cora had been following the trail when the lights in their section failed. In the darkness, something had moved, fast, silent, impossible to track. It had taken Cora first. Meeks had caught only a glimpse as his lumen staff briefly illuminated the scene, a shape that began as human but flowed into something else, its limbs extending, flesh rippling as it adapted before his eyes. He'd fought back, somehow managing to tear the tracking implant free before being struck from behind. We fortified our position as best we could, using the containers to create a defensible perimeter around the laboratory chamber. Lo worked feverishly to extract more information from the recovered data slates while the rest of us prepared for whatever might come in the darkness. Two of us gone, six remaining. The odds were worsening by the hour. As I loaded the last magazine into my bolt pistol, I found myself staring at the empty tank that had once held Subject Prime, the creature we'd glimpsed in the shadows of the main hold, the thing that had survived 60 years sealed inside this metal tomb. The perfect survivor, as Vex Macharia had intended. The scratching in the walls grew louder, coming from all directions now. Whatever stalked us through the hauler's labyrinth was no longer attempting to remain hidden. It wanted us to know it was there, watching, waiting, learning. The lumens flickered, plunging our camp into momentary darkness. When they stabilized, I found myself staring at a handprint on the wall that hadn't been there seconds before. A handprint that began as human at the palm, but stretched into something else entirely at the fingertips. Subject Prime had found us, and it was hungry. I ordered everyone to fortify our position immediately. The handprint on the wall confirmed what I'd feared. Subject Prime was not only alive, but actively hunting us. The sump rats moved with practiced urgency, transforming our makeshift camp into a defensible position. We'd survived ambushes in the Underhive before, but never against something like this. Dex and Lorna deployed our limited supply of motion auspex units at strategic points throughout our perimeter. The devices were salvaged from an enforcer outpost during the Helmor riots, crude but functional. They'd detect anything larger than a sump rat moving within 20 meters. Jax and Holt rigged tripwire alarms across the maintenance duct entrances, connecting them to lumens that would flood the area with light if triggered. Meeks remained semi-conscious, his breathing labored as Lorna treated his head wound. The gash was deep, revealing the glint of skull beneath torn flesh. In the Underhive, such injuries often meant death, but Meeks was resilient. He drifted in and out of awareness, occasionally muttering about shadows that moved wrong and limbs that stretched impossibly long. I studied the laboratory's equipment while the others worked, searching for anything that might give us an advantage against Prime. The specimen tanks offered little insight beyond confirming the horrific nature of Vex Macharia's experiments. Each contained a failed attempt at creating what Prime had become, test subjects whose bodies had rejected the genetic modifications, resulting in grotesque mutations that had ultimately killed them. Low continued extracting data from the recovered slates, his augmetic eye whirring continuously as he processed the information. His findings painted an increasingly disturbing picture. Subject Prime had begun as a convicted murderer from the Underhive, sentenced to servitude in the Corp's starch factories. The BioLogos team had acquired him through unofficial channels, designating him as genetically receptive to their modifications after preliminary testing. The early trials had been promising but limited. Prime demonstrated enhanced healing and adaptability, but remained fundamentally human. The breakthrough came when Vex Macheria introduced a secondary xenobiological component to stabilize the carrion hunter DNA. The records didn't specify the source, but the genetic markers suggested something non-imperial that violated numerous Mechanicus protocols on xenobiotic integration. Whatever Vex Macheria had done, it worked too well. Prime's cellular structure began continuously adapting, evolving in response to each new stimulus. The process accelerated beyond the research team's ability to control it. By the final recorded entry, Prime was demonstrating capabilities that frightened even its creators: enhanced strength, unprecedented regenerative abilities, and most concerning, the capacity to alter its physical structure at will. Lowe's analysis was interrupted by the sharp ping of a motion auspex. Something had triggered the unit near the eastern perimeter. We moved into defensive positions, weapons trained on the corridor leading from that direction. Seconds stretched into minutes with no further alerts, then another ping, this time from the western perimeter, then the northern. The motion auspex units were triggering in sequence, as if something was circling our position, testing our defenses. I sent Jex and Moira to retrieve additional power cells for the lumens from our supply cache near the hauler's entrance. We needed to maintain the light perimeter at all costs. Darkness would give Prime an insurmountable advantage. The pair moved cautiously through the container maze, maintaining Vox contact every 30 seconds as per protocol. 2 minutes later, their Vox cut to static, then silence. I signaled for Dex to establish a sniper position covering the corridor to the supply cache while Holt and I advanced to investigate. We found evidence of a struggle halfway to the cache, scorch marks from Moira's las gun, scattered equipment, and more of the viscous fluid we now recognized as Prime secretions. A sound drew our attention to a nearby maintenance duct, ragged breathing punctuated by soft whimpers. Moira emerged from the shadows, her face ashen, uniform torn and stained with both human blood and the alien fluid. Her right arm hung limp, dislocated at the shoulder, and deep lacerations crossed her torso. She collapsed as we reached her. Between pained gasps, Moira reported what had happened. They'd reached the supply cache without incident and were gathering the power cells when the lumens failed. In the darkness, something moved with terrifying speed. Jex fired blindly, his shotgun's muzzle flash briefly illuminating a humanoid figure advancing toward them. Then the figure changed, its joints dislocated with wet popping sounds, limbs elongating as it squeezed through a gap in the containers too narrow for a human to pass. Jex had pushed Moira toward an escape route before turning to face the creature. She'd heard his shotgun fire twice more, followed by a wet tearing sound and his abrupt scream. She'd fled through the maintenance ducts, firing behind her whenever she heard movement. At one point, she'd glimpsed the creature pursuing her, a thing with Jex's general shape but wrong in fundamental ways, its skin shifting texture and color to match the metal surroundings, rendering it nearly invisible except when moving. We retreated to base camp with Moira, who lapsed into unconsciousness once secure. Lorna stabilized her injuries as best she could with our limited medical supplies. Four of us left now, the odds continued to worsen. Lowe made a breakthrough with the data slates while we reinforced our defenses. He'd recovered Vex Macheria's personal research notes, including observations not included in the official records. The Magos had become obsessed with Prime's adaptive capabilities, particularly its ability to incorporate genetic material from subjects it consumed. The process wasn't just consumption, it was assimilation. Prime didn't simply eat its prey, it absorbed useful genetic traits, incorporating them into its own evolving biology. Most disturbing was Vex Macheria's final note, recorded just before initiating the BioLogos protocol. Prime had begun demonstrating rudimentary tool use and problem-solving abilities far beyond its original capabilities. It was learning, evolving intellectually as well as physically. The Magos theorized that this cognitive development resulted from Prime assimilating neural tissue from the research team members it had already killed. A crash from the eastern perimeter interrupted our planning. One of the tripwire alarms had triggered, but instead of illuminating an intruder, the connected lumen had been smashed. The creature was disabling our defenses, systematically eliminating our advantages. Another alarm triggered to the west with the same result. Prime was learning our tactics, countering them with calculated precision. The motion Auspex units began malfunctioning next, reporting phantom movements or failing entirely. Holt discovered the cause. The power cells had been removed from two units, the access panels carefully opened rather than forced. Prime wasn't just strong, it was dexterous, patient, methodical. I ordered a fighting retreat to the laboratory chamber, our most defensible position. As we fell back, the Vox beacons crackled with static, then emitted a series of clicks and hisses that approximated our communication patterns. Prime was mimicking our Vox signals, attempting to confuse us. I ordered all units switched to emergency frequencies, but the damage was done. For crucial seconds, we couldn't coordinate our movements. In the laboratory, we made our stand. Dex positioned himself on an elevated platform with his long laws covering the main entrance. Lo and Lorna established a fallback position near the specimen tanks, while Holt and I covered the maintenance duct access points. Mora remained unconscious, secured in the center of our defensive perimeter. The scratching sounds in the walls intensified, coming from multiple directions simultaneously. Prime was using the maintenance ducts to surround our position. I caught glimpses of movement in the shadows between containers, fleeting impressions of a form that never quite matched what I'd seen seconds before. The creature was changing constantly, adapting its body to each new environment. A metallic clang echoed from above, something heavy moving through the ceiling ducts. Dex tracked the sound with his long laws, firing a precise shot through the metal. A shriek followed, distinctly inhuman, and a spray of the viscous fluid rained down through the new hole. We'd wounded it, but the victory was short-lived. The fluid began to smoke as it hit the floor, eating through the metal like acid. Prime had adapted a new defense mechanism in response to our attack. Holt collected a sample of the fluid in a specimen container, careful to avoid direct contact. Under Lowe's augmetic analysis, the substance revealed its horrifying nature. It contained concentrated toxins similar to those found in carrion hunter digestive systems, but modified to become more aggressive when exposed to air. The creature hadn't just developed an acid defense, it had weaponized its own bodily fluids. More concerning was Lowe's analysis of tissue fragments suspended in the fluid. The cellular structure was in constant flux, rapidly generating new cells to replace damaged ones. Even separated from the main organism, the tissue continued attempting to adapt and survive. Prime's regenerative capabilities exceeded anything in Vex Macharia's notes. It was evolving faster than anticipated, each encounter accelerating its adaptation. We heard metallic scraping from the corridor outside the laboratory, not the sound of claws or movement, but something deliberate. I risked a glance around the barricade and witnessed something that chilled my blood. Prime, or some extension of it, was manipulating a piece of broken equipment, fashioning it into a crude tool. The creature had recovered a surgical instrument from the laboratory equipment and was using it to pry open an access panel we'd sealed. The implications were staggering. Prime wasn't just physically adapting, it was demonstrating tool use and strategic thinking. It had progressed from instinctive hunting to deliberate problem solving. The creature was creating ambush points throughout the hauler, using the laboratory's own equipment against us. Lowe's continued analysis of the recovered data revealed why the Biologos protocol had been so extreme. Vex Macharia had recognized too late what he'd created, an organism that could potentially adapt to any environment, overcome any defense, and absorb the genetic advantages of any prey it consumed. If Prime escaped the hauler and reached the populated areas of Necromunda, the consequences would be catastrophic. The motion Auspex pinged again, this time from directly beneath the laboratory floor. Something was cutting through from below, the distinctive hiss of a surgical laser penetrated the metal plating. Prime had found another way in, using the tools it had scavenged. We repositioned to cover this new threat, but the cutting sound abruptly ceased, followed by silence. Minutes later, the same sound came from behind us. The creature had circled around, abandoning its first approach for a more vulnerable point in our defenses. It was testing us, learning our response patterns, adapting its strategy as readily as it adapted its biology. In a desperate attempt to gain insight into our enemy, I ordered Lo to analyze the tissue samples more thoroughly. His findings confirmed my worst fears. The creature's cells contained markers from multiple sources. Human genetic material formed the base template, but significant portions had been replaced or enhanced with carrion hunter DNA. More disturbing were the xenobiological components that stabilized this impossible fusion, gene sequences that matched no known imperial record in Lo's database. The tissue samples also revealed something unexpected: mechanical components integrated at the cellular level. Microscopic augmetics merged seamlessly with the biological material, enhancing and controlling the adaptive process. Vex Macharia hadn't just created a biological hybrid, he developed a biomechanical organism capable of directed evolution. The Mechanicus components weren't controlling Prime, they were accelerating its development, pushing its evolution in calculated directions. As night cycle approached in the hauler's artificial environment, we prepared for the darkness. Our lumen reserves were dwindling, power cells depleted faster than anticipated. Prime had adapted to our light strategy, developing enhanced visual capabilities that rendered our illumination advantage increasingly marginal. The scratching in the walls had stopped. The silence was more terrifying than the noise had been. Prime was no longer announcing its presence. It was moving with deliberate stealth, conserving energy, waiting for the perfect moment to strike. The hunter had become more sophisticated, more patient. I examined the specimen tanks again, searching for any weakness in Prime's biology that might be exploited. The failed subjects provided clues, areas where the genetic integration had proven unstable, causing cellular breakdown. If Prime shared these vulnerabilities, we might have a chance, but the specimens were decades old, representing early stages in the research. Prime had evolved far beyond these prototypes. A faint hissing sound drew my attention to Mora's position. She lay motionless where we'd placed her, but something was wrong. Her skin had taken on a grayish pallor and the wounds on her torso no longer bled. Instead, they seeped the same viscous fluid we'd come to associate with Prime. Her chest rose and fell with labored breaths, but the movement seemed wrong, mechanical rather than natural. Lorna approached to check Mora's condition and discovered the horrifying truth. The lacerations weren't random injuries, they formed a deliberate pattern across her torso, creating access points to her internal organs. Something had modified her while she was unconscious, introducing foreign material into her body. Mora wasn't just injured, she was being transformed from within. Prime hadn't just been hunting us, it had been studying us, experimenting on us, using the same techniques the BioLogos team had used on it. We weren't just prey, we were raw material for its continued evolution, and it was learning faster than we could adapt. As Lorna backed away from Mora's changing form, the motion AuSpex units pinged in perfect synchronization. Movement detected in all directions. Prime wasn't alone anymore. It had created extensions of itself, autonomous hunters connected to the primary organism, but capable of independent action. The realization hit me like a shock maul to the chest. Prime wasn't just adapting physically. Its intelligence was evolving with each encounter, developing cognitive abilities that matched its biological transformations. What remained of the sump rats gathered in the makeshift command center we'd established, the gravity of our situation hanging heavy in the recycled air. Holt's motion AuSpex pinged again, but this time in a pattern too regular to be random movement. Three short, three long, three short, an ancient distress pattern. The creature was learning to communicate. Worse, it had figured out how to manipulate our equipment to send signals. The implications chilled me more than the hauler's steadily dropping temperature. Lo hunched over the recovered data slates, his augmetic eye whirring as he processed information at machine speed. His findings confirmed my fears. Prime's neural tissue showed unprecedented growth patterns. The creature wasn't just absorbing physical traits from its victims, it was assimilating their knowledge, memories, and skills. Each of our fallen comrades had unwittingly contributed to its evolution. A crackle from the hauler's long dormant intercom system froze us all in place. At first, only static emerged, but then came something worse, Kulo's voice, distorted but recognizable, calling for help from somewhere in the vessel's depths. The transmission cut off abruptly, replaced by silence that felt more threatening than any sound. Dex raised his long laws toward the ceiling-mounted speaker, but I signaled him to hold fire. Destroying the speaker wouldn't stop what was happening. Prime had discovered the hauler's intercom system and was using it to psychological effect. The creature was employing psychological warfare, using our comrades' voices to draw us into traps. Minutes later, another transmission came through, Jex this time, his voice strained, describing a safe passage through the maintenance ducts that would lead to an exit. The message contained specific references to our previous operations, details only Jex would know. The mimicry was perfect, but the trap obvious. Prime wasn't just replicating voices, it was accessing memories, constructing believable scenarios from information harvested from our fallen comrades. Lorna and Lo worked feverishly to compile everything we knew about the creature. Its adaptations followed patterns, environmental threats triggered defensive evolutions, while offensive capabilities developed in response to our countermeasures. The creature learned from each encounter, refining its approach with terrifying efficiency. Most concerning was its accelerating cognitive development. The earlier specimens in the laboratory tanks showed no signs of enhanced intelligence, suggesting this capability had emerged spontaneously in Prime, perhaps as a result of consuming the research team's neural tissue. Holt discovered something significant while analyzing the hauler's schematics, a reactor chamber near the vessel's core. The MX-45 used a compact plasma reactor for long-duration operations, designed with emergency purge protocols for catastrophic containment failures. If we could lure Prime into the reactor chamber and trigger a purge, the resulting plasma discharge would incinerate everything inside, regardless of adaptive capabilities. No organism, no matter how resilient, could survive direct exposure to unshielded plasma. The problem was accessing the reactor controls. According to the schematics, they were located in the command bridge, which we'd yet to locate. Additionally, the purge would require authorization codes, likely held by the hauler's senior officers or the BioLogos research team. We needed those codes and needed to reach the bridge alive. Lo made the breakthrough we needed. Buried in Vex Macharia's personal logs was a contingency plan. If Prime escaped containment, the Magos had established emergency protocols, including reactor purge authorization codes. The Magos had anticipated the possibility of failure and prepared accordingly. The codes were encrypted, but Lowe's augmetic systems could process them given enough time. A new problem emerged: the hauler's power systems were degrading. Decades of neglect had taken their toll, and our activities had accelerated the decline. The lumens flickered with increasing frequency, and environmental systems fluctuated unpredictably. If the power failed completely before we reached the reactor controls, we'd be trapped in darkness with Prime. We formulated a desperate plan. Lo would continue decrypting the purge codes while the rest of us located the command bridge. Once there, we'd activate the reactor purge sequence, using ourselves as bait to lure Prime into the chamber before triggering the discharge. It was a suicide mission for whoever served as bait, but the alternative, allowing Prime to escape into the underhive, was unthinkable. As we prepared to move out, the motion AuSpex units detected movement converging on our position from multiple directions. Prime had grown tired of testing our defenses. It was launching a coordinated attack, using multiple access points simultaneously. We had minutes at most before our position was overrun. I made the call to split our remaining forces. Dex and Holt would create a diversion, drawing Prime's attention while Lorna, Lo, and I made for the command bridge. It was a desperate gambit, sacrificing two for the chance that three might succeed, but we'd run out of alternatives. Dex accepted the assignment with a grim nod, checking his long laws one final time. Holt's face betrayed no emotion as he distributed the remaining charges from our demolition kit. The plan went wrong almost immediately. As we prepared to move out, the hauler's power grid surged violently. Lumens exploded in cascades of sparks, plunging sections into darkness. Emergency systems activated briefly before failing, casting the corridors in the blood-red glow of backup lighting. Through the chaos, I glimpsed movement in the shadows, fluid, purposeful motion that defied natural locomotion. Prime had cut the power deliberately, creating optimal hunting conditions. We pushed forward through the darkened corridors, guided by Lo's augmetic eye, which could still detect thermal variations in the surrounding environment. The command bridge lay three sections ahead, behind a series of security bulkheads that had remained sealed for decades. Behind us, the sounds of combat erupted. Dex and Holt engaging the creature to buy us time. Lassfire illuminated the darkness in strobing flashes, followed by Holt's distinctive shotgun blast. Then came sounds no human throat could produce, screeching metal combined with organic squelching as Prime adapted to their weapons in real time. The security bulkheads proved less challenging than anticipated. Decades of corrosion had weakened the locking mechanisms, allowing us to force them open with pry bars salvaged from the laboratory. The command bridge lay beyond the final bulkhead, a circular chamber dominated by control consoles and monitoring stations. The remains of the hauler's command crew were still at their posts, desiccated corpses preserved by the vessel's environmental systems. They had died at their stations, following the BioLogos protocol to the bitter end. Low immediately connected to the main console, his mechadendrites interfacing with the ancient systems. The reactor controls responded sluggishly but were operational. The purge sequence required 3 separate authorizations plus the Magos' emergency codes, which Low was still decrypting. We needed time, minutes that Prime wouldn't willingly give us. A transmission from Dex's Vox bead cut through the static, brief, urgent, terminated mid-sentence. The diversion had failed. I ordered Lorna to secure the bridge entrance while Low worked on the reactor controls. The sound of her lasgun cycling to full charge seemed impossibly loud in the confined space. The schematic displayed on the main console revealed the reactor chamber's location, 2 levels below our position, accessible via maintenance shaft adjacent to the bridge. If we could activate the purge sequence remotely, we might escape through the hauler's emergency evacuation system while Prime was destroyed. It was a slim hope, but the only one remaining. Low announced a partial success. He decrypted 2 of the 3 authorization codes and was close to breaking the final encryption. The reactor systems were responding, power levels rising as dormant systems reactivated. We needed only minutes more to complete the sequence. Time ran out when the bridge bulkhead buckled inward, metal screaming as something with impossible strength forced its way through. Lorna fired continuously into the widening gap, her lasgun's power cell draining rapidly with each shot. Through the opening, I caught glimpses of our attacker, a nightmare amalgamation of human and Xeno's biology. Prime had evolved beyond the forms we'd previously encountered, incorporating elements from each of our fallen comrades into its morphology. What entered the bridge defied easy description. Core mass resembled a human torso, but elongated and distorted, with multiple limb structures extending at impossible angles. The surface rippled continuously, alternating between chitinous plating and exposed musculature that flowed like liquid. Most disturbing was its head, or rather, heads. Multiple facial features emerged and receded across its upper mass, each recognizable as one of our fallen comrades. Kulo's heavy brow, Jex's distinctive scar, Mora's augmetic eye socket. The faces shifted and merged, expressions changing in unsettling synchronicity. The creature paused at the threshold, studying us with eyes that constantly changed color and position. When it moved again, the motion was unnaturally smooth, flowing rather than walking. It spoke, not with a single voice, but a chorus of overlapping tones that included the voices of our lost comrades. The words emerged distorted but comprehensible, expressing curiosity about our presence and purpose. It addressed me by name, using inflections and mannerisms copied from Kulo. I raised my bolt pistol, knowing the gesture was futile but unwilling to die without resistance. Behind me, Low worked frantically at the console, his augmetic eye flashing as he completed the decryption. Lorna positioned herself between the creature and the console, her lasgun's charge indicator blinking red, nearly depleted. The creature continued its bizarre monologue, its speech patterns becoming more coherent with each passing second. It explained its nature in fragmented terms, describing itself as the culmination of Vex Macheria's work, not just a subject but a successor. The Magos, it claimed, had ultimately offered himself as the final component, merging with Prime to create something transcendent. The revelation struck me with horrifying clarity. The Magos hadn't died implementing the BioLogos protocol. He had become part of Prime, his consciousness absorbed along with his knowledge. Low signaled success, the purge codes were decrypted, the sequence ready for activation. The reactor chamber's location flashed on the console schematic, a direct path marked through the maintenance shaft. We needed only to reach the chamber and trigger the purge manually. as the remote activation systems had degraded beyond reliability. I made the final, desperate decision. Lorna would escort Lo to the reactor chamber while I held Prime's attention on the bridge. The creature's focus seemed fixed on me specifically, perhaps recognizing me as the group's leader. It was my best chance to buy them the time needed to reach the reactor and initiate the purge. Lorna protested with a fierce look, but ultimately complied. She and Lo slipped toward the maintenance shaft access point while I engaged the creature in continued conversation, asking about its origins and purpose. Prime seemed eager to explain itself, its multiple voices creating an unsettling chorus as it described the evolutionary process it had undergone. It considered itself the next stage in human development, adaptable to any environment, capable of incorporating beneficial traits from any species it encountered. As Prime elaborated on its nature, I noted with growing dread that it was still evolving before my eyes. The facial features shifted more rapidly, new patterns emerging in its surface structure. It was adapting to the bridge environment, developing interfaces compatible with the hauler systems. If it gained control of the vessel, nothing would prevent its escape. The maintenance shaft access clanged shut behind Lorna and Lo, drawing Prime's attention momentarily. I fired my bolt pistol, the explosive rounds detonating against the creature's mass. The impacts tore chunks from its form, but the wounds sealed almost instantly, the damaged tissue reforming with visible modifications resistant to further ballistic trauma. Each attack taught it how to better defend itself. Prime surged forward with unexpected speed, pinning me against the command console. Its mass flowed around my limbs, immobilizing me without crushing. It wanted me intact. Up close, the shifting features were even more disturbing, faces forming and dissolving across its surface. It expressed curiosity about my genetic structure, analyzing my potential contribution to its evolution. Through the vox bead, I heard Lorna's confirmation. They had reached the reactor level and were proceeding to the chamber. Prime tilted what passed for its head, obviously intercepting the transmission. It understood our plan. Multiple limbs extended toward the console, interfacing directly with the systems to override the purge sequence. I triggered my final contingency, a compact Melta charge concealed in my equipment belt. The resulting blast tore through Prime's mass and destroyed the console, preventing the creature from accessing the hauler systems. The explosion threw me clear, though not without cost. My left arm ended at the elbow, cauterized by the Melta's heat. Prime recoiled, its mass destabilizing as it adapted to the thermal damage. The distraction gave me the opening needed to reach the maintenance shaft. I descended rapidly, the pain from my severed arm distant and unimportant compared to the urgency of reaching the reactor chamber. Above, Prime recovered quickly, flowing into the shaft in pursuit. Its mass conformed to the confined space, accelerating downward with terrible efficiency. The reactor chamber was vast compared to the rest of the hauler, a cylindrical space dominated by the plasma containment core. Lorna and Lo had already accessed the control systems, bypassing damaged components to establish a manual purge sequence. The reactor hummed with awakening power, energy readings climbing toward the threshold needed for purge initiation. I sealed the chamber entrance behind me, knowing it would barely slow Prime's advance. Lo indicated that the purge sequence was active, but required 3 minutes to build sufficient plasma pressure for maximum effect. We needed to keep Prime contained in the chamber until the sequence completed. The entrance buckled inward as Prime forced its way through, its mass now incorporating metallic elements harvested from the hauler's structure. It flowed into the chamber like liquid metal mixed with organic matter, reforming into a roughly humanoid shape dominated by the faces of our fallen comrades. The creature recognized our plan and moved to disable the reactor controls. Lorna intercepted it, emptying her lasgun's remaining charge into its advancing mass. The beams cut deep channels that sealed almost instantly, but the attack diverted its attention. Lo continued working at the reactor controls, his augmetics interfacing directly with the ancient systems to prevent Prime from interrupting the sequence. I circled behind the creature, drawing its attention with my bolt pistol's last rounds. Prime divided its mass, extending pseudopods toward each of us simultaneously while maintaining its central form. The extensions moved with terrible purpose, analyzing and countering our tactics with increasing sophistication. The reactor's hum intensified, power levels approaching critical threshold. Low signaled 2 minutes remaining before purge initiation. Prime seemed to understand the danger, its attacks becoming more focused on the control systems. One extension enveloped Low completely, absorbing him into its mass before we could intervene. His augmetics sparked briefly as they were integrated into the creature's evolving structure. Lorna and I retreated toward the emergency evacuation shaft, our last escape route. The purge sequence was now locked, impossible to abort without Low's authorization codes. Prime surged toward us, recognizing our intention to escape. Its mass flowed faster than we could move, cutting off access to the evacuation shaft. Lorna pushed me toward an alternative route, a maintenance crawlway designed for servitor access. Too small for Prime's full mass, it offered our only chance. As I entered the narrow passage, I saw Lorna standing her ground, her empty lasgun raised like a club. She bought me seconds with her life, disappearing into Prime's engulfing mass as I sealed the crawlway behind me. The maintenance shaft led upward, away from the reactor chamber through a series of narrow tunnels barely wide enough for human passage. Behind me, I heard Prime's frustrated screeching as it attempted to follow, its mass too substantial for the confined space. Smaller extensions probed into the tunnel, but the creature's primary form remained trapped in the reactor chamber as the purge countdown continued. I emerged 2 levels above, sealing pressure doors behind me to slow Prime's pursuit. The hauler's emergency systems activated automatically, blast shields descending throughout the vessel in response to the imminent reactor purge. I had less than a minute to reach the outer hull before the plasma discharge consumed everything within the containment zone. The final pressure door sealed behind me as the reactor reached critical threshold. Through reinforced viewport glass, I witnessed the beginning of the purge, blinding white light erupting from the reactor level, consuming everything in its path. The hauler's structure groaned under the strain, decades-old metal buckling as plasma energy surged through containment systems never designed to handle such power after years of neglect. I reached the emergency evacuation pod, a single-occupant survival capsule designed for the hauler's command crew. As I activated the launch sequence, the viewport behind me shattered, admitting a tendril of Prime's mass, smaller than before but still active, still adapting. It had fragmented itself, sacrificing its primary mass to ensure a portion survived. The tendril wrapped around my leg as the evacuation pod launched, tearing through the hauler's hull into the darkness of the underhive tunnel. Prime's fragment continued evolving even as we hurtled away from the disintegrating hauler, its mass flowing upward toward my torso. I fought to dislodge it, but the creature's grip was implacable, its purpose clear. It would consume me, absorb my knowledge, and continue its evolution. The evacuation pod crashed into the tunnel floor a kilometer from the hauler, the impact temporarily dislodging Prime's fragment. I stumbled from the wreckage, dragging my increasingly numb leg toward a narrow fissure in the tunnel wall. Behind me, the hauler's destruction culminated in a blinding flash that illuminated the entire tunnel system. The shockwave knocked me forward into the fissure as debris filled the main tunnel behind me. In the darkness of the fissure, I examined my leg by the light of my failing lumen. Prime's fragment had burrowed beneath the skin, visible as a network of dark veins spreading upward from ankle to knee. The flesh around the intrusion felt wrong, numb yet hypersensitive, responding to stimuli I couldn't consciously detect. The fragment was too small to consume me entirely, but large enough to establish a foothold, beginning the transformation process from within. I made the only choice available. Using a jagged piece of metal from the pod, I severed my infected leg above the knee, cauterizing the wound with my lumen's power cell. The pain was excruciating but necessary. The separated limb continued moving independently, the fragment within it attempting to adapt to sudden isolation. I crushed it beneath a fallen rock, ensuring nothing remained viable. Hours later, I dragged myself through the underhive tunnels toward the distant lights of a settlement. The hauler was destroyed, Prime's primary mass consumed in the plasma purge. But as I reached the outskirts of the settlement, I discovered the true horror of our failure. Near an air circulation intake, I found an empty containment unit, one of dozens missing from the hauler's laboratory. Beside it, a small patch of organic material pulsed with familiar movement, adapting to its new environment before flowing into the ventilation system. Prime had prepared for its possible destruction, creating spore capsules containing fragments of itself. The capsules had been distributed throughout the Underhive long before we arrived, insurance against the creature's primary form being destroyed. The perfect survivor had ensured its continuation. Somewhere in the darkness of Necromunda's Underhive, Prime's legacy was already evolving, adapting, preparing for the next phase of its existence. And I, the last of the Sump Rats, could only watch as the cycle began anew. The horror we'd discovered in that forgotten hauler wasn't contained, it was merely beginning. The last adaptation wasn't physical but strategic. Prime had transcended survival to achieve something more terrifying, propagation. Necromunda's darkest depths had birthed many nightmares over the centuries, but none like this. The perfect survivor would never truly die, it would only evolve,